All right, next on the show, we've got Leslie T. Sharp, the author of The Quarry Fox, a book about critters in the Catskills. Leslie, are you there?
Excuse me, I am, Tom. Can you hear me?
We can hear you, yes.
Great. And I want to thank you so much for having me on. And I also want to say that as soon as I'm off with you, I am going back to the website and I am making a pledge to your station.
Oh, great.
In solidarity with you, your neighbor in Delaware County, and fellow Catskiller. You know, there's nothing more important than these community radio stations and public radio in general, and it's all kind of endangered, as we know. So I'm happy to become a member.
All right. If anyone wants to do that, they can call 518-697-7400 or go online to wgxc.org. And Leslie, tell us about your book, The Quarry Fox.
Well, The Quarry Fox and Other Critters of the Wild Catskills was published in March by the Overlook Press. And Overlook, it's an interesting press. They actually got their start at the foot of Overlook Mountain. Peter Mayer, the publisher, founded it in an apple shed on his property. It's now in the city, and it's a national press, but he's a great Catskiller and the publisher of such wonderful Catskill writers. I'm sure your audience knows Alf Evers, the Catskills, from Wilderness to Woodstock, and they have a real commitment to the Catskills and to the Hudson River Valley. So we were thrilled, my agent and I, when they wanted to do it. That was our first choice. And what this is it's a book about the wild animals of our region here in the Catskills from a naturalist point of view, written in the first person, that combines both the natural history of each animal with my observations. As, again, I'm sure many of your listeners know, that's why we're here, that's why we stay. It's impossible not to get entangled with your critters, whether it's the black bear or whether it's the bluebirds. They really kind of hold our hearts. And this is actually the first such book since John Burroughs wrote about, in-depth book, I should say, since John Burroughs, who was the great wildlife recorder, was writing in the 19th century. And he also was writing out of the Catskills, obviously, out of Roxbury, where his family had his farm. And he was also the founder of the modern nature writing genre, which is such a wonderful and continuing genre of American literature. So hopefully I'm in that tradition, and I'm very proud to have this book out, which is beautiful, beautifully produced. The cover art is by John James Audubon. Can't go wrong with Audubon. And there's lovely interior illustrations as well. And there you have it. And I think anybody here, especially, even though these critters are everywhere, as we know, and in New Jersey, there seem to be more black bears in people's swimming pools than there are in our own backyards, because our black bear is a little bit afraid of people, as long as we put the bird feeders in, don't quite come up and visit. It's a wonderful story, the wildlife of the Catskills, because it really is a monitor of how the Catskills, which was really America's first great wilderness found, at least by Europeans, the Native Americans knew about it, was then lost due to tanning and the overexploitation of resources. And so many of these critters, including the black bear, disappeared, and now they're mostly back.
They're also
an indicator of this fabulous, the health of this fabulous landscape that we all share.
So most animal populations have recovered, or what is the environmental health of the critters in the Catskills?
Well, I think, first of all, the Catskills itself is such an interesting story, because really in the beginning of the 19th century, when Thomas Cole discovered it for the Hudson River School of Painting and brought the Catskills to Europe, that idol that he painted in his wonderful, dramatic, sweeping landscape oil paintings, really by the mid-19th century was gone. Tanning industry, 30 million hemlocks were taken down to get the tannin out of the bark to use as the chemical that would turn cowhide into leather. Excuse me. You know, there was a lot of unregulated cutting down of the forest for timber. There were other exploitations like bluestoning. And of course, you have to balance economic development with other concerns. But this was completely unregulated. And to be fair to people, it seems incomprehensible to us in a way. People didn't really quite know the damage that their action could have. You know, America was young. It seemed the resources, the forests, you know, the streams, everything was limitless. But by the mid-1850s, it had become kind of a ruin, enough of a ruin, that when the Adirondack Forest Preserve was established in, let's say, 1885, and it was done partially as a reaction to what had happened to the Catskills, because with the stream so polluted from all of the chemicals that had been poured into it, let's say by the tanning industry, everything was shutting down. There were no trout. The deer had disappeared. The black bear had disappeared. Now, the major predators, like the mountain lion, although that's another story because people see mountain lions all the time, as we know, but basically as a breeding population, the mountain lions were gone. Other critters like the elk had disappeared. Certainly the gray wolf had disappeared. And these animals that had really indicated the health of the environment kind of vanished. Now, those first big three have never come back. It's still, you know, too many people for, let's say, well, we think, mountain lion. We're not quite sure about that. That's a very open question. But
well, there may be one or two of them, but they're not
well,
populations.
Well, population. We do have accidental releases. There are some legal and illegal kind of game farms. And maybe people have exotic pets, which they probably shouldn't have, and they pop out occasionally. But we have no proof of breeding populations. But when people say they've seen one up here, I never dispute them. Because the folks here, whether it's me looking out my window, I know the difference between a bobcat and a mountain lion, and so do they. And a lot of hunters see them, and hunters really know wildlife better than anyone. But what we don't think we have is a breeding population. And if we had a breeding population, for instance, where I am in the Western Catskills, there's lots of sheep, there's lots of cattle in the valley, we would see kills. And mountain lions kill in a signature way. They jump on your back, they get your neck, they get your throat, and we have no signs of that. You know, coyotes tend to kill in a pack. We know what they do. So I think what's interesting about people seeing the mountain lion, it's really about are wanting to see that wildness, that animal, that big cat, that predator, that hugely, you know, gorgeous creature, which is like liquid grace the way it moves, even though it's a little scary. I don't want one in my backyard. I think it's about our need to be connected to wildlife, and that's one of the things that I try to capture in my book, that it really is about the rewards of those connections and what that really means to us on a very human level, not just the preservation of these hills, which, as I was saying before, have largely come back due to the cessation of certain industries like tanning and due to the establishment eventually of the Catskill Park because the streams did clear. And the irony is the Catskill streams and waterways, which were considered so despoiled that they didn't want to slide them in to the Adirondack Forest Preserve, which originally came out of an attempt to preserve the Hudson River from the same fate of soil erosion, et cetera, that had happened to our Catskill waterways. Those recovered streams and the reservoirs now sort of, you know, fuel New York City. Again, I know that has its controversies too. You know, but the bottom line is the decision to preserve some of our forests, like the Adirondack and then the Catskill Forest Preserve, really were driven by an economic necessity to make our resources sustainable. And the first decision to preserve was really an economic one. And that's, I think, going forward, what we all have to remember, that the preservation of resources, the assurance of their sustainability, is not only makes for pretty places that where we all love to live and hike and hunt and all that stuff, but it also is sound economic policy. And that's what's been proven here in the Catskills. And yes, those critters are back. We now have more black bear in the Catskill per acre, maybe about 2,000, than anywhere in New York State. There are more in the Adirondacks, but it's a much larger area. But per acre, the black bear is back. You know, the deer, which I know has issues because they really do have an impact on our understory and our flora and our vegetation, but
And our gardens, too.
Yes, exactly. But what's so interesting is with those deer, they were gone. And when the Catskills came back, they wanted to reintroduce them. So they penned a bunch of white-tailed deer at the foot of Slide Mountain in the eastern Catskills about the beginning of the 20th century, to reintroduce them. Everybody came from miles around to look at the deer. They hadn't seen a deer in decades. Can you imagine? So, and they reintroduced them, and heaven knows they've been successful. That's the good news. The good news is that these hills are mountains, you know, from the rolling foothills to the high peaks that were impacted, have regenerated. It is a very healthy ecosystem, and certainly one of the most beautiful landscapes in all of America. And in a weird way, it's still our undiscovered secret, this area.
Yes, we're talking to author Leslie T. Sharp about her book, The Quarry Fox. Leslie, are there other stars of your book, critter-wise?
Oh, yes. Every chapter, it's the rest of the title is The Quarry Fox and Other Critters of the Wild Catskills. So every chapter is devoted to either a certain species and within it a family of that species, like my black bears. I have three generations living in back of the house that I've gotten to know pretty well. No, I do not see them. A fed bear is a dead bear, and everyone I know knows that. But the quarry fox is sort of the signature chapter, but there are many other critters that I talk about, from the luna moth, and which is such an incredible moth. It's as beautiful as a painting, and seeing it has always been one of my great thrills. Whether it's the luna moth to any variety of birds, to even our spring peepers. So every chapter is dedicated to a different species, including the Catskill cats, the bobcat, the mountain lion, as much the myth as the reality, and certainly the lynx, which was a higher peak cat, and certainly maybe back in the Adirondacks, we're not sure. And every chapter is also dedicated to a different nature writer or naturalist or nature activist, some famous, some not so much, because it's not really about fame. It's about, you know, one's dedication and absolute love for natural systems. And I think ultimately the point of the book is this, that it's about connectedness and everything. We're in the middle of it, and the ecosystems, now we're learning with the problems that we're having with honeybees that are falling off, and they're such principal pollinators. That affects us. Or as I'm sure people know, our little brown bats, 80-90% of that population, has really, since maybe 2006 when it started, has been decimated through white nose syndrome. And we're not quite sure how it started. We think we know, but the question is, how do we stop it? And the impacts of our bats, which can eat up to 600 mosquitoes in an hour, think of that. And think of the loss of so many of those, you know, nighttime guys. As I write in the book, and it's actually in the chapter Natural Beauties, which is really about moths and about the relationship. You know, it's like you love the luna moth, you love the bat, please donate my luna moth kind of thing.
Yeah, I moved here in 2004, and the one animal that we saw when we moved here that we don't see anymore are the bats.
That's exactly right. It started happening in 2006. We think it was, I don't want to put it out there. There's all kinds of theories as to why we think it may be the result of spelunkers, you know, over even in Howell's Cave. Now we're going to blame it on the Europeans, right? People from another place tracking stuff in on their shoes or whatever, and that it's like everything, you know. It's kind of like when the Europeans came to this country and the Native Americans caught all kinds of awful things because they had no immunity. Well, it was the same thing with the bats. Whatever was brought in now has just become an epidemic. Now things are a lot more, it may be a little late, but things are a lot, you have to sort of walk, I think, on a surface that, you know, disinfects your feet, that whole thing. But that's really an issue, and there are some hopeful things. Weirdly, there's a similar bat species in England, I believe, that has the symptoms of white nose, which is that kind of white fungal stuff around the snout, but they have the manifestation, but they don't have the symptoms, so it has immunity. So we're sort of looking at that and saying, huh. And of course, there's an impulse, can we inbreed them? But it's such a tricky thing. When you start doing that, there's often, for every action, there's a reaction. So, okay, let's inbreed them now, what will happen? But what you just pointed out, since you've come here, and the diminution of the bats, as I write in my book, you know, as a little girl, I remember, because I was always interested in birds, and I was like president of the Junior Audubon Society in second grade, which is the thing I'm most proud of in my life, I have to tell you. And I remember looking at pictures of the passenger pigeon, and it was like, wow, that bird is gone, and it used to darken the skies. It was shot out of existence. But extinction seemed like the dinosaurs. It seemed to be something that happened then. But to go through an extinction of a species, now, the brown bat is not going to be completely extinct. I mean, there are bats, the cave bats, although it's affecting more than that. There are, I think, how many cave species? I think there may be 3 cave species, and they're all being affected because it has something to do with caves. Might also have global warming in there or climate change in that, without using those buzzwords. But if you have warmer winters and the bats come out of their hibernation, then that stresses essentially not only their immune system, but they've preserved all this fat to sleep through winter, and if they wake up and start flying around, then they become weakened and they become more susceptible to various hosts. But all this stuff that I'm saying, I'm certainly not an expert, and I'm sure there's probably a ton of even more recent research than I'm talking about here, but there is a correlation, we know, between some kind of invasive fungus that these guys picked up. And it's not just, you know, the idea of 600 mosquitoes in an hour, it's not just, gee, I'm going to sit out on my deck tonight and I'm going to get killed by mosquitoes. And we know that they're carrying dangerous diseases, so these bats are even more important. But the economic impact on our farming industry, because these guys eat all kinds of pests. And not only that, if you have more bats, then you don't have to use so many pesticides, and that saves. So all of these impacts on our ecosystem, you know, really do add up to the idea that we're all connected and that we are at the center of that connectedness. And I think all of us who live up here and who look out our windows really have a very deep sense of that connectedness, much more so than the average city person does, who is so removed from the fact that their water comes from the Cannonsville or the Tepacton reservoirs, which are near me, as opposed to me, who goes out to my spring every morning just to make sure I have, is that running successfully? And I've lost water. I'm sure a lot of folks have had dried up wells and springs like I've had. So we know the impacts of drought firsthand. So it's I think the book, more than anything, is about connectedness.
And if you just tuned in, we're talking to Leslie T. Sharp, the author of The Quarry Fox, published in March was it Overlook Press?
Yes, the Overlook Press.
And the critters in the Catskills, and here at Wave Farm, we've got a patch of milkweed that we don't cut down. What are kind of things that people can do to help the animals?
Well, I think that milkweed is great. Obviously, that's something that the monarchs need to lay their eggs on. It's an interesting relationship that goes on there. They lay their eggs. The eggs absorb the bitterness of the milkweed. And interestingly, that makes the milkweed, that makes the monarch taste terrible. And most flying critters, if they have even one experience of it, won't go near it. But it's really about things like sustainability. We could sort of say, well, there are wonderful environmental organizations from National Wildlife to Audubon to the Nature Conservancy. You can join, you can become active. But there's so much you can do just in your own backyard, and you don't have to be on the side of a, you know, Catskill mountain like I am. I mean, whether it's having that patch of milkweed, or some of these organizations have what they call the Backyard Habitat Movement. And my land has been certified as a wildlife habitat by National Wildlife. And all that means is I have shelter for critters. I have places where they can breathe. I have water. Now, you know, just even putting out a bird bath. Now, being sure to change it, we don't want mosquitoes, you know, laying eggs in there, that kind of thing. You have to be vigilant. But a bird bath, because we forget that birds in winter as well as summer really, you know, need water. There's also all kinds of planting of native species, milkweed, is part of that, but there are many other different flowering plants that will attract hummingbirds, that will attract butterflies, all of those wonderful creatures that, remember, those butterflies are not only beautiful, but they're pollinators too. And their numbers as the honeybee, as habitat is lost and as pesticides are used, I think that's key. Pesticide-free land is very, very important. I just got a tweet from a great guy named Dave Schoen. He's in Western New York, and he's a forest guy out there. And he tweeted me and said, can we start a movement that tries to make, you know, clover and dandelion status symbols? You know, everyone sort of wants to have that manicured lawn. I understand that. My parents, who lived in the suburbs of Philadelphia, certainly had that. But, I mean, his point is that even dandelions in the spring, when the honeybees are first flying and it's cold and there's not a lot of flowering plants, they're a tremendous food source. And, of course, clover is the key, especially red clover, but white clover. Those clovers are very, very important. But here's something else, and all of you out there, it's firefly season. And I was kind of horrified because my college roommate, she lives in Woodstock, Vermont, with her family, and she had emailed me and said, Les, you know, we didn't have fireflies last year. What's going on? Like, oh, gosh, do I have to know about this, too? And I did a little research, and what's happening, it's habitat loss, it's pesticides, but there's something else that is so simple. Apparently, it's light pollution. And I had to learn this just recently, that light, outdoor lighting, now we're really only talking about the month of June into early July, because they don't fly through the summer. That, you know, the flashes of those lovely fireflies that we see are really mating calls. So that last night, which was a nice mild night here, I was thrilled. I was looking out at the front meadow and they were going like crazy, whereas the night before it was pretty chilly. It was down to 50, not really too many. But that's what they're doing. They're signaling their mates. Now, can I give you an explanation of what the firefly's purpose is in nature? I'm not even sure. I know that they're pretty bitter too, and other critters and aggravate them and annoy them. But what they are with their flashing lights, it's like little neon babies advertising the miracle of nature. And you can just turn your outside lights off. And that also affects the Luna moth. Because here again, you have the Luna moth, which is a benign moth. Those giant silkworms do not, there are not enough of them to, like, cause trouble, you know, like the evil gypsy moth at all. But that guy is very sensitive to light. So I have a, you know, security light up back, and I had to learn this, too. It's a sodium light. And I would be thrilled because the Luna moth would be drawn to it. I could see it. And then I learned, no. It's wasting its time beating its wings. It only lives 2 weeks. It's in love with the darn light, and it's not mating. So simple things like that. Just turn off your outside lights at this time of year. You do such a service. And the night of the solstice, I came out onto the front deck, and it was, I was staggered. If people remember, if you were outside, you know, at the moment of 12:10 when we began summer, the sky was so clear, and the stars were so vivid. They were just, I could see the Milky Way. We have no light pollution here. And it was just like liquid. But then I looked in the meadow because it was a mild night, and all of the fireflies were ablaze in the meadow. It was as if they were like tiny fallen stars, you know, had come to the meadow from above. And I have to tell you, I was so staggered by that sight that I didn't go inside. I stood outside, you know, hoping not to get bitten by everything. And I just saw this interplay of the stars in the heaven with our little stars, which are the fireflies. And I'm so happy to report that the fireflies are not disappearing due to any affliction. It's just something that can be reversed. And we've had a lot of cases, the bluebird population, where when people give them a little bit of help, they'll come back. And maybe the moral of our Catskill story is, if you give nature a chance, it will rebound stronger than ever. So that's maybe the message. I'm sorry I get so enthusiastic about all this.
That's all right. We're talking to Leslie T. Sharp, the author of The Quarry Fox, and it's our pledge drive, too, so you can consider calling in 518-697-7400 or go online to wgxc.org/donate to make a donation. One final question, I guess, is why did the quarry fox get headlining status?
Well, the quarry fox, without giving away the story of the book, without giving away what happens in that chapter, was it really summarizes, in a sense, the incredible interplay between people and wild critters without sentimentalizing. One of the things that a naturalist can't do or shouldn't do is sentimentalize, really. By sentimentalize, I mean attribute to wild animals our own human emotions. The other thing we shouldn't do is fall in love with wild animals. I fall in love with them all the time. And since nature is about only the cycle of life and death, essentially, just the regeneration of species, my heart's always broken. But my heart's always rewarded, too, because we do have great success stories. And the quarry fox really was a very poignant tale about this one fox on the side of the mountains that really basically had as his territory the Bluestone Quarry, which is on the other side of the mountain. And my interactions with that wild animal who had such extraordinary intelligence, that's the one thing I can certainly say, in curiosity, and really kind of his story or her story. It's very hard to decide if a fox is a male or female. Whosever story that was so profound and was such a life changer for me here in the mountains that I had to tell it. And I, as I said, I don't want to give it away, but it was just an amazing animal. And again, I'm sure a lot of your listeners have had that kind of interaction with wild creatures.
Yes, and we've been speaking with Leslie T. Sharp, the author of The Quarry Fox. Leslie, can you shout out some particular bookstores in the Catskills that are carrying the book?
Well, you can get The Quarry Fox certainly online at Amazon, at IndieBound, at BNN. I think you can certainly order at your local bookstore. I mean, most bookstores, whether it's the Gold Notebook in Woodstock, whether it's the Green Toad in Oneonta. Now, Catterskill, which is in Hunter, is carrying it. And I also just wanted to say that I'm going to be at the Mountaintop Library in Tannersville on Saturday, July 8th from 2 to 4 with Christine Wade, whom some of your listeners may know. She's a wonderful writer. Her book, Seven Locks, is historical fiction, which is set in the Catskills in the pre-Revolutionary War era. And Christine and I are going to be doing a joint program on the histories of the Catskills. I'm doing the natural history. She's doing the human history. It's a free event, and what's really fun, we'll blab for an hour, but then at 3, we're adjourning to a local distillery, everyone. I have no idea if there's a charge to get in, but there will be kind of wine tasting. So this is something that one can't resist. It's not just histories of the Catskills. It's a chance to have a glass of wine at least. Whatever that is, winery, distillery, I'm not sure, but it's the Mountaintop Library in Tannersville, and as I said, the bookstores in Hunter are carrying it. You can always order it anywhere, and you can certainly find it for a great price online.
And if
anybody's listening who wants to go to that event that has bought a copy, bring your copy. I'll be glad to sign it for you.
And that's at 2 p.m. Saturday, July 8th at the Tannersville Library?
At the Mountaintop Library in Tannersville. Christine Wade is worth listening to. She's terrific, and she's a wonderful writer, and it's kind of fun. It's the two different aspects of the Hudson Valley Catskill area.
All right. Well, then stop out July 8th if you want to hear more about the critters in the Catskills and the quarry fox at the Tannersville Library.
Thank you so much, Tom.
All right. Thanks for talking to us today, Leslie.
Yes, and I'm going to go on right now, and I'm pledging money to your fabulous station.
All right. That's 518-697-7400, or go to wgxc.org/donate.
Thanks again, Tom.
All right. Thank you, Leslie.
Good luck with your back.
All right.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right. You're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre.